You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, July 14th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. I am in a remote location, but not so remote that I couldn't find my soft-collared shirt, but remote enough that I'm wearing nothing else. Joining us on this Casual Friday, has it been already just a week? Cliff Schechter will be with us to, I want to say look back on the week, but really it's we just need to look back in the past 3 or 4 hours. Also joining us to give us a streaming movie recommendation for the weekend, Matthew Film Guy will be with us. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans desperate to pass a health care bill. It's not about the policy anymore, folks. It's about the politics. And surprise! There was a little bit more to that meeting Junior had with the music manager, the head of his father's campaign, his father's chief advisor, a Russian lawyer, and it turns out to be a lobbyist who was a former Soviet agent.
Private conversations.
We're up to 6 people in that meeting now. I think by the time this is over, maybe the entire Russian choir, the Russian military choir will have been in there.
Oh, so people can't meet with people now. I guess we should just have war with Russia. Okay. Joy Reid agenda.
Meanwhile, Trump's lawyer seems to be slightly on edge at the moment. And Milo Yiannopoulos' 15 minutes of fame may be up, but he's still getting that sweet, sweet Mercer money. And the Freedom Caucus is now stalling the Republican budget. God bless them. God bless their hearts. And lastly, a federal judge in Hawaii, in fact, ends up expanding the list of relatives who are exempted from Donald Trump's Muslim ban. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Man, yesterday the fun half of the show got super fun.
Did you see the guy tweeted us the how to argue Monty Python sketch? I was thinking we should have pulled that.
I know. Well, we have our Monty Python clip for the day, and that is when Trump and Macron shook their hands again. Macron definitely seems to have realized at one point, like, you know, they went back and his advisor said, dude, you can try and, you know, go mano a mano on this guy, or you can also recognize he's a moron and we can take him. We can fleece him like everybody else is. And I think they're going towards the fleece thing. This is the one thing I got to say. I mean, this is a slightly off point, but I realized that I had reached a level of maturity when I first sort of came to the conclusion, like, oh, when I go in and meet with this person or that person and they're an idiot, I don't have to say you're an idiot to them. I could actually just take from them what I want because they're an idiot. And that is like, that didn't happen to me until
a couple years ago.
I think it's six months ago.
Mouths of babes. Hello.
But Macron figured that out. And of course, Trump had the obligatory, your wife is hot moment.
You know, he was planning that for weeks, like ever since the original handshake. I'm going to go for World War II tribute day to France, and then I'm going to grab his wife.
We'll read the excerpts from, apparently, I did not get briefed on what Bastille Day was and Armistice Day. I can't remember. Why do they have so many days? Ladies and gentlemen, Donald Trump is not the only person who occasionally travels. I am one of those people, and now I do it. I don't know. Here's the thing. My whole life, and I realize that, like, when I go and do a remote broadcast, it's so much about just, I need, everything is habitualized for me, right? Because I do a daily show, and so everything, I have to know, like, oh, this thing's to the left, that thing's to the right, I have to have that email account open over here, and I have to have my IOMs over here. And so when I travel, I have, like, all my gear already in, like, prepackaged little things and labeled. And the key for me has always been to try and find a suitcase that actually I can fit everything into, that is going to get me on the plane, off the plane. Well, today's show is brought to you by Away. Away offers high quality luggage that's designed to be resilient, resourceful, and essential to the way you travel. And I gotta say, when you get a suitcase that works like this, I'm not being, I know this sounds a little bit over the top, but the thing rolls so easily. Like, you see those people and they have the four-way rollers and you're like, what? Why? Why are they doing that? And you know what? When you get one, you realize why. It's significantly better. They're available in 9 colors and 4 sizes, including carry-on sizes that are compliant with all U.S. major airlines. The Away suitcase is lightweight. Totally lightweight.
Totally.
So lightweight. Lightweight's important.
You ever feel anything this light in your life?
Honestly, I mean, this is a big deal for me because I carry my microphones. I carry my mixer. I carry the mic stands, the cables, the phone.
Glasses.
Rate, my glasses, extra pair of glasses just in case. It's also got a TSA-approved combination lock, so you can lock it, but the TSA has some special key that they open it up. 4 360-degree spinner wheels, which I used to look at and laugh. Like, why would you want that? And I'll tell you something. It's the thing moves like butter. And it's also got a patent-pending compression system to help overpackers. Better yet, both sizes of the carry-on are available to charge anything that's powered by a USB cord. What? Wait, what? Yeah, and I still try and figure out, like, where they have the battery, because it doesn't seem to take up much space at all. But when you're at the airport and all those chumps are trying to fight over the one outlet to charge their thing, boom, right into your own suitcase. And thanks to Away's lifetime warranty, if anything breaks, they'll fix it or replace it for you for life. And here's the best part. And I love this. I love that there are companies that are doing this. You can try out your Away suitcase for 100 days. Travel with it. Take pictures of it. Pack it and unpack it like I do, practicing. And then take pictures of how you pack it because you're a little bit OCD maybe. I don't know. Is that OCD, or I just don't like to have to rethink about these things anymore? And if at any point you decide it's not for you, you return it with a full refund. Shipping's free within the lower 48 states, so you got nothing to lose. And the other thing about these things is that they fit inside each other. So we got a big one and a small one, and they fit inside each other. But I mean, like, they nest inside each other. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/majority. Use the promo code majority during checkout. That's awaytravel.com/majority. Promo code majority for $20 off your away suitcase. I'm not revealing too much to people to tell them I would actually pack my suitcase and then take a photo of it.
I think they're not revealing anything about yourself that observers of you wouldn't already guess.
All right. That's just how I would make sure. Because as I was saying, it sounds like that sounds like it could sound like it's weird.
Oh, it's weird. Without a doubt.
I think it was weirder when you said you've realized how you can exploit people that are less intelligent than you.
I also thought it was particularly weird that you publicly announced that.
Well, I don't run into anybody else anymore. I mean, I'm done. I'm done taking meetings, so it doesn't happen.
Everywhere, and I'm just seeing mouth breathers all over it. I scheme them with
course,
my...
You and Matt are far too intelligent for me to do anything like that. You guys are great and very powerful. Also, you're in great shape.
Isn't your wife beautiful, Sam? Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
What shape?
Let's go. Let's play this clip, and then we'll go get Cliff. Jesse Waters, as you know, is on the five now, and I do
he
remember
could be taken advantage of.
I do, and I do remember when I read that, or I think maybe Benjamin texted me. He's like, "Dude, Jesse Waters on the five," and I'm like, "Please tell me you're not joking, because this is going to make my life slightly more enjoyable." Jesse Waters on the five yesterday. He is defending, and you know, look, I suggest that people exercise caution in making assumptions that go beyond the facts that we know at this point. If I was Jesse Waters, I would not say anything for at least the next 12 to 18 months about anything. He went full bore yesterday. He was on the five defending the Trump family from charges of lack of patriotism. And then the best is how he ends this diatribe, as everyone else is. Well, one of the five is rolling his eyes at Jesse Waters. Listen to this.
While you have the floor, let me just butt in for 1 second here. I'm very sick of the left calling the Trump family unpatriotic. They're now the McCarthyites. Let's remember what party defeated the Soviet Union while the Democratic Party was trying to appease and mimic communism.
Yes.
Democrats have been cozying up to dictators and our enemies for years, giving
Still
the Iranians billions of dollars, giving the North Koreans billions of dollars, shaking Hugo Chavez's hand, shaking Castro's hands. The Clintons were taking money from Chinese nationals in the 1996 reelection campaign and then selling satellite technology to the Chinese that enabled their missile program to blow up. The media colluded with the Democrats, letting Hillary cheat during the debates. President Obama palling around with domestic terrorists sitting in the same church as an American-hating preacher. The Democrats undermining the military.
Let me just say, this is
giving birth to ISIS, lying about a terrorist attack on the eve of the election. No, no, let me finish.
How much can we take?
Donald Trump's family has done more for this country than any Democrat elected official.
Yeah, really.
He has provided more jobs in the real estate industry, in the fashion industry, in the hotel and casino industry. He's created more wealth for anybody in this entire country. So to smear them as mafia or unpatriotic is absolutely shameful. And I think everybody needs to wake up and realize this family is a patriotic family.
Oh, yeah.
And what's happening right now is a coup against the will of the American people.
All right. So we'll take the part about having Joey No Socks at all his functions and how what a smear it is to say the guy's involved with the mafia.
Yeah, he's a great fucking opponent of the Soviet Union.
But my favorite part is at the end, Jesse Waters says there's a coup going on against the wealthy, which is basically saying, like, they're attacking the oligarchy. There's a coup going on against the wealthy.
You guys want some missile technology? Here you go.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I'd sell it to the highest bidder, but I do take some comfort in the fact that you're also really America's strategic enemy.
I just don't know if he knows what a coup means.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say he does not. I miss just racist street harassment, Jesse Waters.
Yeah, and now Jordan, the defending not even defending the oligarchy, basically saying like they're trying to keep the rich from running the country.
Yeah, he's not doing the oligarchy any favors by drawing the line so directly.
Yes, you may want to keep that under your hat, Jesse. If you're aware that they're running the country, you may just want to keep that on the down low.
Hey, you ever read Walter Snelson Yeatsen? Great fucking book. Or Alexander, whatever the fuck. He resisted totalitarianism. Major fucking moral leader. So when a certain says the Soviet Union and Hamas are the same thing and Obama likes fucking both of them.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter will be joining us. We are back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Majority Report. On the phone, a man who will be deprived because of my remote setup today of hearing the song that always ushers him in. But you, dear listener, shan't be deprived. Here it is.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Yes, Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Have you shared your remote location?
Well, I'm up in Apple Country. Let's put it that way. The guys are back in the studio. They can hear you. You cannot hear them, sadly, because I can't figure out my mix minus situation. But I'm not going to bother people with the vulgarities of my lack of audio mixing knowledge. Instead, Cliff, let's discuss healthcare 2.0. It feels like McConnell is following the House playbook, which is get the conservatives and then beat the hell out of the moderates.
Yeah, and predictable, right? The moderates, also known as the wimpy wing and the disintegrating wing of the Republican Party, who, you know, on some of the worst legislation that was passed under the Bush administration, and obviously joined in with right-wing Republicans and opposing very reasonable, some would say even moderate bills that President Obama tried to pass during an economic crisis early on and various other things. So, I mean, no surprise there. We always knew it was going to come down to about a half dozen or so votes. It seems like, if I'm correct, Rand Paul's already said no just because he wants to run for president and would say no to almost anything they offered up. And the only so-called moderate that said no is Susan Collins. So they're at 50 right now.
Yep.
But Dean Heller, who had all these problems, seems like he's backing up. Dean Heller and Rob Portman are interesting in that both of their governors have said this is unacceptable.
Yeah, Brian Sandoval came out and said, and it seems to me, I mean, obviously for Portman, Kasich has always been sort of, you know, his own thing there, it seems to me. Like, that has less import than Brian Sandoval coming out in Nevada saying this is unacceptable. But I don't know that it's going to make a difference to either one of them.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, but Rob Portman does like to play the role of moderate here. And, you know, Kasich doing that. I actually do think that makes Portman look worse. He really doesn't. He likes the genteel extremism, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So this way, it sort of exposes it. It's going to be interesting. And then, of course, you know, Shelley Moore Capito and Lisa Murkowski have pointed out all the horrible things this does to certain rural members of their states, as have Jerry Moran from Kansas and Bill Cassidy. I always suspected that a few of those would cave in the end. But I find Heller to be incredibly interesting, being from Nevada. And apparently, you know, if he caves, I think he has definitively lost his job. So who knows what they're promising on the horizon?
Well, Dean Heller, I mean, the thing with Dean Heller is he's afraid of both a primary and the general election, right? I mean, he's got all the problems of the Republican Party. He has the conservatives' fear of being primaried and the moderates' fears of losing in the general. Here's the tell to me.
But somehow,
oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah. Well, I'll just say quickly. Somehow, in both, just thinking of two states, in Maine and in Ohio, Susan Collins, who's been there for numerous terms, and Rob Portman, who just ran for his second term and won overwhelmingly, they both were able to, you know, placate. However, behind the scenes, whoever they needed to placate, the powers that be, to make sure they had no real legitimate conservative opposition in primaries, even though they both broke away from their parties on a number of things, but enough things that you would have thought they would have been challenged. So I don't know. Maybe Heller can't figure out a way to pull off the same thing in Nevada.
One of the things that I think really is the most telling to me, apparently, the moderates, the so-called moderates, right? The Collins, the Dean
right.
Hellers, the Murkowskis, Portman, they were in with McConnell yesterday for 2 hours trying to work this out. That, to me, sounds like people who are desperate to vote for this bill and trying to figure out a way to vote for it. Right. I mean, it doesn't sound to me like, you know, and this is an important dynamic to keep in mind, because they're keeping in those taxes on the high earners that Obamacare instituted. So there's, when they get the CBO score, there's going to be even more money to throw at this. And I think that long term cut to Medicaid is such a prize.
Well, that's
and
right.
And you can do the tax cuts later in the year. You can do them later in the year, it seems to me.
Passed on their own, it's much harder for anybody to oppose them. You pretty much can guess every Republican will be for it, and even some Democrats up for re-election will be tempted by it. I mean, the thing with Medicaid that still, though, you know, they threw in some opioid money, which doesn't come close to making up for the Medicaid cuts. And so in kind of opioid central, you know, which is where Portman and Capito, for example, are representing, it's fascinating to me how they're going to how the two of them are going to try and justify it, assuming they vote for this thing.
Well, they're going to, you know, look, $45 billion sounds like a lot of money. You know what I mean? I mean, that's basically what it is. It's just all they're doing is going in and they're saying, look, here are the size requirements for the fig leaf I need. And you need to show me a fig leaf.
They need enough cover.
I show it to my constituents. If they seem to think that it's covering everything, then, you know, if no one says like, oh, my God, I can see you're, you know, creeping out underneath that fig leaf, you better get a bigger one.
I see something to say.
Yeah.
Well, but there's also the kind of what, you know, what they think works, you know, at the current moment versus if people have figured it out by the fact that they're losing their health care within a year or two. So down the road when these guys have to run for re-election, there's a whole lot more uninsured people in their states and they can know exactly who to blame for doing it. You know, I mean, there's been so much press around this. Again, you know, you never underestimate Republican propaganda and their ability to sort of pipeline it through Fox and Breitbart and those kinds of places. But it does make you wonder, because I agree with you, they may find the fig leaf in the short term, but in the longer term, people are going to know whether they have health care or not.
Well, look,
and I think they have a pretty good idea that I had it and it was taken away after that bill was passed. So they can try to blame it on, you know,
but my understanding is that McConnell is actually saying to some of the moderates, look, the biggest cuts in Medicaid don't happen for 8 years. So it's going to be past all of your re-elections, A, and B, it may not happen. I mean, because this is what's happened. You know, there were cuts in Medicare. And each year we would get the doc fix. You remember the doc fix? The DOC doc fix. And basically what that was, it was on the night before the following year's budget, they would come in and basically fix the underpayments for doctors for that year. And they could only do it for a year. Because they couldn't get it took them a long time to get a permanent fix on this. But the fix was
That was the most Washington thing ever in Washington.
Yes.
They took something that was completely ridiculous that they should have handled long term, left it to the last minute every time. And they also, of course, gave it a sort of nickname that made people even more bored hearing it. So what the hell was doc fix? I mean, I think that's about as Washington as it gets.
But I mean, think about what this means as to what they're passing here. McConnell, and I don't know if he's right or wrong about this, but he's arguing that even what we're doing is not really going to happen. We just need to vote for this.
We just need to say we passed something.
Well, we passed something. We need to be able to say to a large part of our party, we cut stuff from poor people.
Oh, sure. We need to tell them what we did.
I mean, this is...
Like the conservatives, to make them happy.
It's insane.
We need to be able to say we passed something that's good. Yeah. So that's ridiculous. But, I mean, there's so many other things. There's the stupid Ted Cruz amendment that's in there that, you know, rebrands high-risk pools, which don't work, and they have no money for, and uses that as the excuse to deregulate other healthcare plans because... You know, if you're not somebody in a high-risk pool, you can just get some crappy plan that doesn't cover most things. Oh, except for when eventually you do get something, which is the whole point of insurance. I mean, the whole thing is utterly ridiculous. I don't know if you saw, just a little side note, who knows what can happen here. And again, don't bet against Republicans suppressing votes and doing what they need to do. But you may have seen that Beto O'Rourke outraised Ted Cruz in Texas.
Yes.
And it was largely the Bernie, Howard Dean, Obama, you know, model of small fundraisers. He doesn't take any corporate PACs. And he raised 2.1 to Teddy Boy's 1.6. I'm telling you, that's going to be one to watch, especially if this passes and this with this dumb amendment. But really, no matter what, because nobody likes Ted Cruz, even people that somehow agree with him. So
yeah, I mean, I think Ted Cruz has a problem. He's like the old model of a, you know, an updated, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, product. You know, like Ben Sasse is the new Ted Cruz in some respects. And so Ted Cruz has just been trying. He's been so lost, really, since he endorsed Trump that he's been, it seems to me he's constantly trying to get his footing. And I don't know if this is going to work or not, but apparently just about an hour ago, John McCain claims that he is going to vote no on pushing the a procedural measure that would get the bill going forward. And that would be joining Collins and Paul. And
interesting.
Now, you know John McCain more than anybody. I mean, what's he trying to do? Just get.
I have no idea what the hell he's doing. I don't. Because there's no. He doesn't need it. The only. I mean, and clearly, there. I mean, again, I never will sit there and say he has no principles. He has a couple things in which he sticks by, and which is admirable. But on most things, you know, he still gives into his party, and he as you've seen him do so far, all these supposed institutionalists that have been around for 30 years that care more about the institution of the Senate and the country than just party, him and Orrin Hatch and Chuck Grassley, these guys always end up giving in to McConnell and doing what's necessary. So the only thing I could see him maybe trying to do, if I don't know what their relationship is, but maybe he's trying to protect Jeff Flake. So it comes down on him and not Flake, who's running for reelection in Arizona. Again, a state that the Republicans only won by about 3 points, if I remember correctly, this past time, and is quickly trending Democratic. That's the only thing that comes to mind, but I don't even know his relationship with Flake, and McCain has so many bad relationships. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
We'll have to follow. And I mean, and again, if it's true, I think it also then is a sign the whole thing's going down, because I don't think McCain's doing that on his own.
Yeah, in other words, he's not sticking his neck out unless he's already got his finger in the wind.
Yes, that a half dozen, all these other people we're talking about, if McCain votes no, I'm pretty sure that most all of them vote no, too.
I'll tell you something. If this thing doesn't pass, and this is why I keep thinking that it will pass, is that if this doesn't pass, everything seems to me to fall apart for them. Legislatively.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what they're going to be able to pass if they can't pass this. I mean,
what do they claim to try to want to do next?
Well, tax reform is next big thing. But, you know, the Freedom Caucus is pushing hard on the budget. And if they don't join the idea that Ryan could go, maybe he goes to Nancy Pelosi and says, give us some votes on the debt ceiling, and maybe Nancy Pelosi does that. But, you know, then it just seems to me you've got an all-out civil war there in the Republican Party with absolutely no legislative accomplishments. No side can go into 2018 and say that we did something.
Right, and the thing is that also, you know, tax reform, again, everybody, I said earlier, in the Republican Party likes a tax cut. But I should get more specific, which is it does kind of in some ways depend what is in there, because they've even found a way to fight over that amongst themselves. Some of them want the capital gains cut more. Some of them want the income tax cut more. I mean, you know, they're fighting around over those things, too, depending upon what state they're from and who will be helped and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you know, they could find a way to fight over that and not get that done very easily.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. It's incredible. I mean, again, they're not made to govern. It's an opposition party made to insult everything that's modern and progressive and forward thinking. It's not made to govern, this coalition.
I mean, it really is amazing. And hopefully, I mean, and I want to be clear, what Cliff and I have just discussed is exactly what McConnell is telling them. McConnell's telling them right now, if we don't do this, you're all in trouble. We're all in trouble, because if we can't do this, we can't do anything else. And I'm not saying that. I'm saying that mechanically, they can't do anything else, because a lot of their tax cuts relies on the ability for them to get to some type of baseline with this Obamacare thing. And if they can't do that down the road, you're right. I mean, it's just as contentious with tax reform. And again, it's a same situation. It's a reconciliation deal where they're subject to the Byrd rule. And, I don't know. I don't know what they think. Maybe you know, maybe Mike Pence will be a caretaker for 2 years while they're not doing anything. But let's talk about that. I mean, because the healthcare thing, look, we're now, it's now July 14th. There's going to be a CBO score in the next couple
Happy
of days.
Happy Bastille Day to all of your listeners.
I think you mean Armistice Day. Oh, no. Okay. Sorry. I don't know if you saw that that Trump interview where he said, where I think he got confused between Bastille Day and the 100-day anniversary of World War One. But
I think he said that what was key to remember is that that Andrew Jackson really had a lot of problems with in regard to Bastille and storming the Bastille, but he felt it necessary along with Frederick Douglass to do that.
They're all getting much bigger.
Perhaps it could have been solved in a different way, perhaps.
They
could have
okay,
been, maybe
sorry.
Could
Go
have
ahead.
Done it in a different way.
My little lame joke break. Go ahead.
All right. But so the week starts off. There are two big stories, it seems to me, that you know, are and I one could actually the one that's getting less attention could be the more important one.
That is true. If I think I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Well, Trump Jr. Has a meeting. You know, everybody's up to speed as far as yesterday. But as of this morning, it turns out that there was another person in that meeting who
whose name I can't pronounce. Rinat Ak, I can't pronounce any of these. Akmetshin. The key point to it doesn't matter. You know, as much the name doesn't matter as much as his occupation. He has worked for numerous oligarchs and the Russian government, and is KGB, or I guess no longer KGB, GRU, connected as a I think we call them spies. But he runs a combination. He's done a combination of things. His expertise: negative PR campaigns. That doesn't sound familiar. He's been accused of hacking his opponent's emails and stealing information for these campaigns to attack people's reputations. And the key thing that he worked on recently with a Russian propagandist filmmaker, and even got shown at the museum under great protest, was a film about how the Magnitsky, if I'm getting that right, which is really the sanctions that we've passed here, should be undone because that guy was really a tax evader and terrible. This Russian lawyer, who of course ended up dying in a Russian prison after being beaten to death. And having, you know, all this stuff trumped up against him, no pun, of course. And that's the very same thing. So actually, the easy thing here is to summarize the two people. Now they're saying there may have been a third person in the room. One can only guess who that may end up being.
There were two people in the room. I wasn't there. Totally not me.
It was the butler with the candlestick in the billiards room. That's what I'm going with. Okay, so here are the two people who are in the room. A KGB, or let's call it a Kremlin-connected lawyer who'd been working on undoing the sanctions and had been defending a client of hers who was accused in money laundering.
I dig that.
Trump people were very popular in. And the money laundering case that she was defending, that's right, Jeff Sessions recently dropped that case and settled before jurors were picked.
Well,
that's
she was in great shape.
The other person in the room, that's right. And the other person in the room is a Russian spy who's worked on negative PR campaigns for oligarchs and the Russian government. And his big thing was also undoing Russian sanctions. And he's known for hacking other people's emails. Seems like those two things are completely unrelated and all this is just a coincidence.
I mean, it's weird to me that they thought, well, I guess this stuff comes out in dribs and drabs. But I mean, you know, I don't. You know, and I, who knows when you're feeling under siege, like maybe we shouldn't, don't mention the part about the guy with the former Soviet counterintelligence. That guy, I wouldn't mention him when you start to talk about this. And, but what's clear too from sort of analysis of the emails, you know, I think Chris Hayes pointed this out, that Don Jr. had actually spoken directly to the pop star that this guy Goldstone represents before the meeting. And so they knew quite well what they were going to that meeting for. And, you know, I think there's more to come out from that, depending on who starts to sing a little bit. Now, Trump's lawyers have said we should not be discussing stuff with Kushner about Russia because Kushner has his own issues going forward.
Yes.
And, you know,
Trump's lawyer, you mean the guy that like cursed somebody out in an email just for like questioning him?
Well, look, that's a Jew on Jew thing. So you can get away with that, apparently. But
did you see that? That was awesome.
I did see it.
Jews. We're going to do an argument.
We'll talk about that in the later in the show. But let's talk about this because Digby has a piece at Salon that that touches on this a little bit. And we know, look, right now we know for a fact, whether you think it's warranted or not, folks, that the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and the special counsel are investigating Jared Kushner's digital operation and its potential relationship to Russian operatives. He's been
and that was the part that you brought up, Sam, that you said that I think that hasn't been as well covered because of the other stuff, but maybe the bigger story in the end, because Kushner, that was his little sort of his baby on this campaign, was the digital operation. We know that they hired Cambridge Analytica, the group run by crazy billionaire Mercer and his daughter Rebecca, who are partially owned by Bannon. He's on the board. Bannon's on the board. You know who else consulted for them? Kellyanne Conway. That's how she was introduced to Trump. It connects all these people. And of course, this particular operation was also involved, and they bragged about their ability to suppress votes. Again, negative PR, if you will, to find a way to get people who, you know, African Americans and women in this case, in key states like Michigan and Wisconsin, to avoid voting for Hillary Clinton, not to come out and vote for Donald Trump, but just to say, ah, screw it, and maybe vote for Jill Stein or not vote at all or whatever. Well, yeah, they also were involved in Brexit, which was another surprising outcome. I mean, sort of the implications of this, if they're busy working with the Russians, because in the end, and this has been charged too, that Farage, the right-wing leader in England, has been accused of being in Putin's pocket also, that you've got this, you know, this authoritarian country who is willing to do all the PR, the negative PR and the targeting that needs to be done. They just need to know who to go after,
right?
Because they're not experts in American politics or British politics for that matter. So you have Cambridge Analytica, and in the American case through Kushner, is able to provide that.
You get all the voter rolls, you get all the, and yesterday I was, we got a call from, somebody, and I don't think.
Oh, and let me say one more thing, Sam.
Go ahead.
Let me say just one more thing also. That would explain the hacking of the state voter rolls too, because you steal the information of who actually votes, and then you can take that information, share it, and then do a deep dive into the analysis of which of those people whose names you have are most likely to vote for your opponent, and then you give that over to the Russians to run their PR campaign.
Right, and there was also, you know, the story, and this is you know, we got a phone call about this yesterday from someone who has been. Well, yes. I mean, and I don't think it's the actual Billy Buckner,
no,
you know,
it's him.
Just hearing the name itself is just sort of difficult for me still.
It's very difficult for you. I'm sorry, Sam.
But there was also the case of the Republican operative, I think, in Florida, who had gotten hold of some voter files and left it up on a server for some time for whatever reason. And I got, you know... it was argued to me that it is because I have said in the past that I didn't think that this was determinative because there are literally, I think, a half a dozen, if not a dozen, but fours as to why Clinton lost this election. But his argument was like, look, the idea that these people with these data files and with this type of basically army that could swamp the Facebook feeds of these people in specific key districts and not change the influence the outcome there by 0.008 or whatever percentage point those less than 70,000 votes across three states represent in, you know, the election. He felt that I was being obtuse, I guess. But
I mean, look, we don't,
you know, and this is all just, these are all just investigations at this point, right? I mean, this is all speculation still, at least parts of it are speculation. Some of it we know to be the case. And I have to say that the thing that comes out of the meeting with Trump Jr. for me, okay, and Jared Kushner was there as well, is that there seems to be, you know, a demonstrated willingness, eagerness to pursue this, and which to me is sort of is shockingly stupid, but yeah. I you know, they have shown that they were willing to do this, that they felt like so untouchable that they could do it, and there's no indication after the meetings that, and if there was, look, if there was an email exchange where, you know, Donald Jr. was emailing Kushner, or if Kushner got an email that said, hey, man, sorry, that was absolute BS, we got to make sure we don't get involved in that stuff in the future, they would have released that on his Twitter feed, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
The point is,
Don Jr. is dumb enough to release everything else.
We're seeing a snapshot in time. And something happened before and something happened after, like any snapshot in time.
Can you imagine if these guys' emails were hacked, what we would find?
I mean,
it's frightening.
The question is what was their disposition? So, you know, the in my mind, you know, I don't think anything's been proven yet, but certainly my perspective on the likelihood of it has changed, you know, to some degree. Because, you know, and
well, I mean,
started the
say,
week
would,
saying this with
say,
those Don Jr. email meeting, and it's only gone further in that direction, it seems to me, since then.
When you say you don't think anything's been proven, though, you're talking about collusion now.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, I'm making sure. Well, you're not talking about actual Russian hacking.
Well, I mean, I think I don't know what that means when you say that. Like, it's clear that there was there was an attempt to access voter files in a number of states, right? I think almost two dozen, and
right.
But
and DNC emails and the server and John Podesta's emails.
I mean,
right? We know all that.
I don't know if we know that though. If that was, I don't know if we know that. As a fact, I mean, I know it was put out, but the idea that it was necessarily the Russians on that, but you know, to me, it's sort of secondary.
Oh, Sammy, I feel very differently about that. I think the combination of various factors, some of which, you know, there's so much flying at you daily, I can't even remember all of it. But at this point, you know, and whatever I think when I see an overall intelligence report from our country, from all the agencies signing on, not to say that there's never been anything that they haven't told us before, but, you know, the agencies of foreign governments and the various other things we're finding out here, I'm pretty sure at this point I'd say that the Russians were heavily involved in this. And the question becomes, you know, how much of that, if any of it, did they plan with Trump's people.
Right. I mean, I think, like, look.
But you're still not convinced.
Well, I'm not. I'll say this. I'm not. It just still doesn't make sense to me that, like, we're going to plan to release John Podesta's emails. Okay, we'll do sanctions. I mean, that to me, it may be. Look, it's clear the Trump people knew from this email that the Russians were working on Donald Trump's behalf. Right. I mean, it's stated there in black and white, and Donald Trump Jr. didn't go,
right.
Hey, wait, what? I didn't know that. I mean, that's something that would
right.
stand out. And I just don't know if there is there was, you know, that's proof of collusion, I guess, as to whether or not they did
the
DNC hacking of the emails. I mean, it's very possible. It seems so unlikely to me that they're going to say, like, go after John Podesta's emails, because those are going to be The gold mine.
I don't think they just went after Podesta. He just, sadly, his staffer made that stupid mistake
right.
and told him to click on the thing. They happened to get John Podesta's email. So I think they went after a lot of other people's, and they didn't bite on the fish, on the catfishing campaign. So they weren't caught. And Podesta had some things that were mildly embarrassing to people, and there were people criticized each other, and they're just trying to sow as much dissension as they could. Now, I'm fully convinced on the Russians' involvement based on their history, based on what they've done recently, based on things that have been said.
Why wouldn't they? We do this. That to me, that stuff is sort of second order stuff. It's really the question of like how much did
the collusion stuff. I'm with you. Right. I don't know because it's clearly here's what seems clear to me. Don Jr. and the other guys there tried to collude.
They were certainly eager to. There's no doubt. And that's what I'm saying. Yes. At the beginning of this week, I was like, why would they ever do that? I can't believe. Oh, my God. They really wanted to. I don't know if they were successful. But, the idea that like they would just try once. We're just going to do it once. If it doesn't work out in this meeting, let's move on to something else. I find that hard to believe.
And then the timeline. The fact that Trump starts referring publicly to his big speech, which he ended up canceling right after that, about all the stuff he was going to release on Hillary. I mean, again, there can only be so many coincidences.
Well, look, let's just briefly talk about
facts here.
Let's just briefly talk about this. What we do know for a fact is that both members of the House and members of the Senate, including McConnell and Ryan, were briefed about all this stuff contemporaneously. Sometime in the summer, sometime in the fall. And Mitch McConnell basically said, if you go public with this to the president, we're going to destroy you. We're going to
claim it's partisan. Yeah. And yeah. But these guys, again, whatever, you don't need to know what their motivation is or any of that or something. All you have to know is what they did was they decided that their party's winning a presidential election was more important than their country because they were told that this was being done to help Trump, that there was this kind of hacking, and all they'd do was come out and condemn it and say that it was going on. And they wouldn't even, that's Devin Nunes was in there too, they wouldn't even do that. And they've known since 2015, so during all the time that Trump's made statements he's made about fake news and this and that, they've failed to rebuke him. Let's remember also that a recording came out from the House Republican Caucus, where Kevin McCarthy, majority leader, got up and made a joke, and that he claims is a joke, but not all of us. It doesn't sound like a joke when you listen to it, and makes the claim that he's pretty sure that Dana Rohrabacher, who's another Putin apologist, House member from California, Republican, and Donald Trump are being paid by Putin. Add that in there too, so that these guys have been pretty sure that something untoward has been going on. And this was right after Trump got the nomination that Kevin McCarthy said this, something like 7 or 8 days afterwards. And this party that believed that this guy was being paid by the Russians, that was told by the intelligence community that the Russians were hacking and doing other things on his behalf to try to help him win, were still completely comfortable in not saying anything publicly and threatening the President Obama and jumping out and getting behind this guy to be president. And that is huge in and of itself because, there has been, again and again, this is just talk out there right now. This is not something that is as hard news, in terms of as the stuff we just said, but of a RICO case, which is essentially what's used to bring in mobsters for conspiracy. And so I think there will be a time where the question might also be, what did Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell know and when did they know it? And it really would explain a lot for why they fought so hard to protect this guy and to undermine any investigations in the House. Because if it's going to hurt them too, and the danger of that, of course, is how far they'd be willing to go to protect themselves. Trump.
Devin Nunes went and spoke to Paul Ryan before he head over to the White House that time. And I would love.
And
to
before
know
he told Adam Schiff, the minority ranking member on the Intelligence Committee, and was said the day before he got a sudden phone call and jumped out of his Uber from his staffer and went running. I mean, he's knee deep in this too. Again, if there's nothing to it, then he's covering up nothing. but he clearly is not doing his role on the intelligence committee. Right. He's working with the White House. So, I mean, you know, this would dwarf Watergate because you didn't have the involvement of the legislative branch in Watergate. And if this is accurate, again, if these guys are involved, all we know so far is we know what they were told. We know what one of them said out loud in a meeting he thought was safe. And we know that they've defended this guy, this president of theirs, every turn. But if it ends up that all equals something, we're in for some ugly times. Because anybody who thinks Mitch McConnell is going down without a fight, I've made the argument on Twitter and other places that everybody talks about the norms that Donald Trump has undermined. You know, Mitch McConnell is probably the person by far the most responsible for destroying democracy in our Senate.
He's an innovator when it comes to that. I mean, the guy he prevented, for God's sakes, a president from having a pick. I mean, that was crazy.
Right.
But
he prevented it. But that's one in a long line of when you added the turning the filibuster and something that was used only in extreme circumstances into a regular occurrence. He's the one who added his name and legal muscle to lawsuits to undermine McCain-Feingold and allow as much money into the process as possible. From the financial incentives to do the wrong thing to the partisan party incentives to do the wrong thing, he's done everything possible to destroy any comedy and any possibility of both sides working together. He was also the innovator of the refuse everything Obama comes along right. with plan during a financial and economic crisis in this country. So he's been in a uniquely damaging figure, and is not often. He's the Calhoun of this century, or of this period of time.
But Cliff, let's not forget, he brought you and your wife together. Cliffy,
I have to always love him and forgive him for that.
Cliff, thanks so much, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care. My pleasure, buddy.
Cliff Schechter, ladies and gentlemen. Boop, boop. All right. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Matthew Film Guy will be joining us. What's that?
Oh, no, it's fine.
There's a little hiccup on your voice there, but it's fine now.
Am I voice?
Yeah, but...
Am I still there?
I think maybe when you hung up on Cliff or something happened with your internet there, but it's fine.
Okay. I will say this. Jamie Dimon says, being an American abroad is almost an embarrassment. Being responsible for, in part at least, for millions of people losing their jobs and their homes, not so embarrassing. But now having Donald Trump as president, it's an embarrassment to him.
He's just so vulgar.
You know, I wonder if Jamie Dimon ever looks in the mirror and go, like, I wonder if, like, our destruction of the economy in any way led to any of this. Nah, I doubt it.
The nice thing about money overseas, though, is money doesn't get embarrassed.
Money does not get embarrassed. But I wonder if Jamie Dimon realizes there's a coup against the rich.
Did you hear that? This was an amazing point. He said, money never gets embarrassed. Isn't that unbelievable? It's such a point.
Do we want to play Jimmy Reefer Cake?
Oh, yeah, yeah. What do we? Oh, yeah, we have the Jimmy Reefer Cake song. Let's also look, while we're at it, we've been talking about this stuff. Here's Ali Velshi deciding to go after Corey Lewandowski, who was interviewed by Chuck Todd, I guess. I'm not 100% sure why, but is Lewandowski still on CNN?
No.
Oh, he's not? Oh, okay. So he was auditioning for a spot on MSNBC. Let's hear what Ali Velshi had to say.
I don't know the reason. I wasn't invited to the meeting. As you know, I wasn't on the email chain. I wasn't even made aware of the meeting. And what I do remember on that particular day was a day that Donald Trump was doing a rally in the state of Florida. So I traveled with the president that day.
Okay, here's what we know. The president did not actually have a rally in Florida on the day of Donald Trump Jr.'s famous meeting. He was in New York City, and he attended an event at the Four Seasons. He left that event just after 1 p.m., 1:07 to be exact. He headed back to Trump Tower, which is just moments away, just a few blocks away. Donald Jr.'s meeting was scheduled for 4 p.m. that day. So was the president at Trump Tower during the meeting? We don't know. But a whole lot of people would like to find out.
That's when I would hit my Perry Mason button. How hilarious would that be if he was in the meeting?
Actually, and they still thought they could get away with not disclosing that?
I wasn't in the meeting. There's someone in the building who looks just like me.
It was John Miller.
I don't even know why you would bring that guy. Why would you bring him into the meeting?
Trump?
Yeah.
Deals.
Why wouldn't you? I make deals.
I'm making deals.
I'm a deal maker.
These Russians are going to want... Could you see, like, Manafort at this point? I've started to genuinely feel bad for Manafort.
I hope Tiffany was in the meeting.
Oh, it's so great. Manafort's just like, you probably shouldn't come to the meeting because this is totally illegal. I want to come. All right, fuck it. Okay, sure. I'm going to get fired soon anyways. Well, working with, like, Russian mafia guys are way more emotionally stable than this guy.
All right, let's hear the Jimmy Reefer Cake song. And he was supposed to clip this so that we could actually play it, you know, during the course of the show when it came up. But this is my understanding is this is an homage to our caller, isn't it?
This is Ronald Reagan.
Okay, so this is an homage to one of our more prominent callers in the Fun Half. Now, people who only listen to the Free Half probably don't really fully know. They're not getting the full experience, ladies and gentlemen. Go ahead.
Well, the call from Ronald Reagan is the best part of the show. No offense to our friend John in San Antonio. I asked Ronald why he likes to call. He said because we think Ronald is funny, but his wife no longer does. Yeah, Ronnie came on my podcast, and he's a real nice guy. He mediated the feud between Michael Brooks and I. We even talked about the debate between Sam Cedar and Jimmy Dahl. Oh, go on, check Redirect Podcast if you want to listen to Ronald Reagan some more. Yeah, a call from Ronald Reagan. Yeah, the best part of the show. No offense to our friend John in San Antonio. I asked Ronald why he likes to call, and he said because we think Ronald is funny, but his wife no longer does.
Bravo, bravo, bravo.
Terrific work.
We could probably clip that ourselves just to maybe just the chorus there, and but
for
in the meantime,
Ronald Reagan song.
Yes, in the meantime, now Ronald Reagan, I think, has certainly been IMing the show for a long time. But I feel like he also IMed Break Room Live, if I remember correctly, maybe even before that. All right, wow. We're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, Film Guy Matthew.
Bad movie where there's no crying, handing the keys to me in this red line. Where the lock that you locked in the suite says there's no prying. When the breath that you breathed in the street screams there's no science. When you look how you look then to me, then I cease lying and fall into silence. So there's no climax, no more new territory. So pull away your max. In the slot that you sliced through the scene, there was no shyness. In the plot that you passed through your teeth, there was no pity.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. And of course, it's Friday. On Fridays, we used to make every guest come on Friday and suggest a film or a video for us to watch over the weekend. But then we decided, why would we ask everyone when we have perhaps, well, I don't want to say, I mean,
go on.
Gives it, perhaps one of the better ones, maybe, as represented in this little ditty. Matthew, film guy. Matthew, film guy, welcome to the program, Matthew.
Thank you, Sam. Pleasure to be here, as always.
Now, it is my understanding, this is the first time that you've been on the program, since we released, and I know some people still haven't gotten the email, we're going to send out another email blast, since we released... And I think we did put on a link on the homepage, didn't we, Michael, on majority.fm? We should do that.
Oh,
please.
No,
the
we link. Didn't. I thought that was only going for members. I'll do that today.
No, no, it is only for members, but put it on the member post.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So of the behind-the-scenes video you did at our April 8th first live show, and I have to say... The accolades have been pouring in, Matthew, from all quarters.
Wow. Well, that's just icing on the cake, Sam.
We had one from Canada, one from, I think, Chicago. That's about it. Maybe Somerville.
That's a lot. That's enough. Mm-hmm. But I had such a fun time shooting it and editing it and presenting it to you guys in the studio. It's really just icing on the cake to hear that people actually enjoyed it. But I'm very glad to hear that. It's very rewarding to hear all those kind words, even if some of them are you know, from second or
facetious.
Third-hand source.
Facetious.
Yeah, or facetious, yeah. Thank you.
Some of them are facetious.
But what did people say was their favorite part about it?
All of it. I mean, some people said, like, oh, I like to finally see the faces of some of the IMers. Some people said,
yeah,
like, oh, boy. Yeah, Kelly came off as a school marm. Sam seems to, you know, she's make sure that these guys get their act together. People like.
Yeah, well, I thought I captured everybody in their true essence, don't you? I don't think there was any. I think I really went for a cinema verite feeling there, if not in style, at least in content.
Yeah, no, I thought you captured it quite well, Matthew. So kudos to you. You got a lot of
thank you
plaudits. So what are you doing now? You're teaching your learning annex class. How are you weathering? Let me ask you this. How are you weathering this whole Trump? You know, I don't know. There's two dual tracks to our politics these days. You know, one, the actual politics and policy, and there's definitely some havoc being wreaked. And then there's the sort of slow, I don't know, degradation of the Trump administration, it seems like, but maybe not. I don't know. What's your perspective?
I've basically been adopting the same kind of strategy as the elites in our country. I'm just managing the decline as best I can, really. So that's taken a lot of different forms. I'm still doing a lot of different corporate video work, which, for better or worse, keeps the lights on around Langdon Boom Productions.
And that really manages the decline because you are making sure they have a soft landing for their corporate work. Now, tell me, you don't have to be specific about the companies, but what...
No, I won't.
Be a little bit more explicit about what it is that you do. Like, you go in and you're like...
No, I don't make that.
Incorporated for many years.
I never make that.
Widgets.
That.
What do you do?
First of all, I never make that sound. That's a terrible sound. But what I do is a lot of the content I do is corporate messaging. A lot of it is promotional videos. Some of it is internal stuff.
Buy our pharmaceuticals. Our pharmaceuticals are the best. You are very lucky to be a sales rep of Benson Pharmaceuticals.
No, Sam, no, that's not it. That's not it at all. I can see why you've had to fall back on the podcast thing. That's not it. It's interviews, it's internal video sometimes. Sometimes a company will want to do something instead of a PowerPoint. It's not that exciting. Let's move on past this, because this was just the setup to what it keeps the lights on. But I'm still doing videos and film for the people who I actually appreciate, such as yourself. Not that that was a financial windfall for me, but I like to keep involved with things that make me excited to actually make them. I just actually got done directing, and I'll soon be editing an hour comedy.
Hold on, did you think I was just going to let you roll by that part where you said, like, not a financial windfall? What do you? Come on.
Well, I didn't do it for the money, Sam. You know that. I do it for the love of the show. I'm a huge and for the continuing free membership to the show. That's really what I do it for. So over the years, so,
I mean, services in kind. It wasn't just for the money. Yeah. It was also for the services in kind. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So wait, you're directing really a show?
Yeah, we shot it last week at the Village Underground in Manhattan.
Wait,
you know,
what show?
Ted Alexandro's new hour special.
That's weird.
It's really weird. I just seem to remember somebody saying,
I'll get you on that show. Is this
this is his hour stand-up. There was no room for you in his hour stand-up. So, you know, this is...
So you're telling me there was nobody else associated with that? There was no other actors at all?
No. Zero. No. Well, there was an opening act. It was Rachel Feinstein was the opening act. But, I mean, I don't know if you've got a tight 20 minutes like Rachel does. She's, you know, she's what they call those non-failed comedians. But, hey, let's move past that, too. This was a great shoot, and it's going to come out on some streaming service. They're still negotiating who exactly, but I'm about to edit it. It was a 5-camera shoot, really well done. We had a great DP, made it look really nice. Yeah, this was no rinky-dink operation. Mary helped produce it with me, and it came out amazing. And Ted Alexandro is a comedian that, if you're not familiar with, you really need to listen to his stuff. I think he's one of the great comedic voices working right now.
I feel like we've had him on the show. We've had him on the show.
Yeah, I think you did. He was active in Occupy Wall Street. You had him on back then, I do believe. He's also, in addition to being an amazing stand-up, he's an actual, living and breathing political activist. He's involved with a lot of different organizations, and he's always on marches and spending his free time actually trying to make a difference. So he gets a lot of respect from me for that. But it's great that he is also a brilliant comedian, because it makes working with him all that better.
Wow, a 5-camera shoot. That's a serious shoot. And will you work in a live switcher or no? Or you'll do this all?
No, I'm editing it all that now. We shot, 4K with cinema lenses, so we have a really nice look.
Did you make sure the sound work, Matthew?
You know what? After that one time, I think I'll never make the sound not work again.
Was that Benjamin's, pajama?
It was both. We need to have John Benjamin and Tom Sharpling on to discuss that, because that was the nexus of our three lives right there at that moment. Right.
I think I've talked to Sharpling about this. He produced.
I know
it, right?
every time he's on, you're sure to mention that, which I love. But yes, that was we're going on. That's 15 years ago now. So I've taken strides in my professionalism since then. But yeah, that was the live John Benjamin recording that somehow someone on my crew, I won't say who, ruined the sound for it.
Who?
But you know what? That's all in the past.
Who was it? Are you still friends with that person?
I mean, we're acquainted.
What's that? You're acquainted? Who is it?
Yeah. It was actually my friend Jesse, who I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but he brought in a few of his friends that were like film buddies. And listen, there was not a lot of money to go around on that shoot at the time. And it was a brave new world of digital video at the time.
Not that brave. Not that new.
Yeah, I mean, it was still bravish, newish, but
recorders had been out for quite a while. Audio
it was
cassette 19, recorders.
It was 2002, I think, or 2000 and probably 2002.
Was it? Jesus.
But anyway, all of these things go into making a professional with experience better and stronger and tighter. So, but anyway, Ted's special, by the way, is going to be called The Senior Class of Earth. And it has a lot of personal and political content in it. So
what does
I really,
that mean, the senior class of Earth? We're the last group?
Yeah, that may exactly be it, Sam. Yeah, very well done. Yeah, there's a bit to it, so I won't give it all away. I'll let Ted's words carry it. But yeah, that is the working title, and I'm sure I'll be back on when it's actually out and streamable. But yeah, so I've been doing that, and like you mentioned, I've been doing the teaching thing. I've also been involved in some local activism, which I don't know if you want to talk about that at all.
Oh yes, I know. You sent me pictures of you giving like a what was going on there? You got like a you were.
That's right.
Tell me what I couldn't quite follow it. What you made
okay,
the local
so
paper?
Yeah, it was. Well, it's New York One. It's not just local. It's citywide. Excuse me. There was several media outlets
local.
There to cover this.
I mean,
yeah,
city-wide.
Semi-local, not, yeah, exactly.
Oh, no,
but
it wasn't
anyway,
borough local. Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it was all five boroughs, all five, okay? I'm pretty sure it even made it to Staten Island.
Okay.
But anyway, that's not important right now. What's important is that I got involved with the fact that on Astoria Boulevard, where I live, it's an access road for semi-trucks, tractor-trailers, and the whatnot to get from the Triborough Bridge to the BQE. I know this is really interesting to people who don't live in New York City, but it's a stretch of road where, semi trucks and loud noise.
You're
machines.
A NIMBY, right? You're a NIMBY.
Well, it's not just NIMBY. It's NIMBY-area. So it's like, it's a health hazard. It's a sound noise pollution hazard. And for at least 15 years, I've been trying to get in touch with whomever is in charge with allowing this change to be made. As you might know, Robert Moses didn't let trucks over a certain size go on what he planned to be his parkways, which I don't know if you know the kind of class analysis of how this came about, but in New York City, he made this law that said like only parkways can have only passenger cars, so your escape to the Hamptons doesn't get ruined by the sight of giant trucks.
Is
well,
there a parkway to the Hamptons? I thought it was Long Island.
The Grand Central Parkway. That is the one that is the issue here. So we're trying to get them to let trucks on just between the bridge and the BQE, which now they have to get off. It's connected by the Grand Central Parkway, but they have to get off and ride on the normal streets because the parkway can't allow these trucks. So we have to compete with these giant noisy machines.
I see.
You can click the link, put the link on the site, and you can see what this issue is.
Okay. People are
but
probably
I was able to stand
there
with, yeah, definitely clamoring, I'm sure. I met Joe Crowley, our representative from Congress. I met Arvita Simonis, who's our state assemblywoman, and a lot of other local officials. And in fact, next week there's going to be a town hall with Mayor de Blasio, and they asked me to come and speak at it so I could raise this issue with him. So
really?
We're moving forward.
Now,
yes.
What is it? Why are they doing it? Just because you're a well-spoken young man, or what is it? Are they know that
probably
you get all
they've
this?
Probably because they've gotten emails from me over the past, 5 or 6 years, them specifically, to about this issue. So, yeah, it's
Mayor de Blasio,
they
hello.
Knew that this was something that I could speak about, and I was happy to be used.
Well, and this could be the beginning of something huge.
And I will await to see your. I will wait to announce my run for governor's office on your show. So don't worry, you'll be the first to know.
Well, I mean, this guy. Let's play this clip of Democratic Councilman Fernando Cabrera. He is from the Bronx, and not from Queens, as you are. However, I don't know. Maybe you go into a carpetbagger. Here is Fernando Cabrera explaining to a room of people. He is a Democratic councilman. And I should say he's also, he is run up against, well, he's bemoaned liberals who kept him from winning his a seat in the past, a Senate seat, I believe it was, because he is, I think, arguably anti-gay. I haven't read too much about this guy, but very socially conservative. And here he is explaining to people Matthew, that it is much harder to be rich than to be poor.
Do you know it's harder than being poor? I know you don't believe what I just said.
Sounds great.
But being rich, you got more responsibility. You have more things. So when you work 9 to 5 and you're just maintaining, okay, I got my thing. Well, you are rich. You have more things to worry. Millionaire people, they have a lot of stuff to worry about, more stuff to manage, more stuff. It's really they got there because of their ability to handle more pressure. Every CEO, every president that got in there and stayed there is because of their ability to handle pressure. They had increased their capacity. You know why your boss pays you what he pays you? Because of your capacity.
There you have it.
I can't believe they didn't take him out on a rail.
I heard a bit of it on the delay.
Yeah, he's basically just saying, like, you don't know. It's much harder for them because they got a lot more things to juggle.
I believe it's the mo money, mo problems philosophy.
Yes. Exactly. You got such a headache. Like, where am I going to put the fur sink?
Mo money, mo problems.
Well, once you
you and I can't know. How can we know?
This is my experience. When you get the fur sink, right? At first, you're like, this is wonderful. And then you have to worry about how you're going to care for it. And then you got to where am I going to buy my fur sink cleaner? Where am I going to do this? All of a sudden, they don't have it at the local store. You got to send away for it. Oh, well, I'll just have Alfred, my butler, do it. And then it's complicated because then I've got to explain to Alfred because I don't want him to actually use my fur sink. I've got to explain to him the dynamics of it. I want it to be fluffy. I don't want it to be matted down. I don't want it to be greasy. I want it to be, I don't want it to be too oily. I mean, it's very complicated. And you can spend hours on just how are you going to clean your sink?
I assume that it is extremely difficult to get toothpaste out of a fur sink.
It's extremely difficult. And then, I've got
And that's every day.
I've got to source a special toothpaste. Oh, this is more complicated. And then the day is over and you got to stay up all night to do your work.
I don't know where this guy's been, but his message is one for the ages. I don't know why he hasn't been more popular on the national scene.
So now, Matthew, let's talk about stream. Are you watching Handmaiden's
Tale? No, show more videos. I can't hear. Go ahead. That's better.
Are you watching Handmaiden's Tale?
No, I am not watching Handmaiden's Tale. Mary and I have been catching up on Twin Peaks, so all of our TV viewing has been going right to the Red Room and the Black Lodge and so on.
Now, this Twin Peaks, is this a new version or is this the old version?
Well, we've been catching up on the old version, which came out in the early 90s, but
yes.
Showtime has been running a new series, a sequel basically, that takes place 25 years later, as fans of the original show will remember was somewhat promised at the end of the first run.
I would never got into Twin Peaks.
You should. You should get into it now. You really should. All your Garmin Bozia should go into that show.
Hmm. All right. Well, what do you have for us this week, Matthew? I it's a shame we can't talk about Handmaiden's Tale because I watched the first season.
I'll catch up on that.
Yeah. All right. Well, good. I want to see if... so far, I'm one of the few people. Has anybody in the office seen it?
No, I'm like you.
Same.
No one has seen it, huh? Okay.
I honestly,
I guess
Sam,
I'm the only one who finds the commander to be a sympathetic character. But okay, let's.
I'll keep that in mind. But let me just say this last thing about Twin Peaks. It's probably the greatest thing that ever aired on broadcast television. I mean, it's so ridiculous that it got through, especially in the early 90s.
That's true.
The Showtime version just kind of ups the level of bizarre quality. And I mean, it has a message that I think is really resonant if you can kind of parse through some of the bizarro nature of it. But it, just about the way that man and nature interact. I mean, it's some very broad themes, but I'm loving it more than anything. And it's really reinvigorated my love for David Lynch. And Mary and I are now going on a huge David Lynch jag. But that is not actually what I came here to say. I just
now,
want to
Lynch,
impress that
I would be surprised. I'm a little surprised that you're a big Lynch fan, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I am too, actually.
Okay. All right. Then good.
Well, when I was in high school, I'll tell you this. When I was in high school and I was a 17-year-old just kind of getting into weird cinema, Blue Velvet was like a movie that we had like memorized. And just like the character of Frank Booth, Dennis Hopper's character, was just, we thought that guy was the funniest thing ever. And I literally put like the dialogue onto a cassette tape so I could listen to it in the car. So I had a real phase, let's say. Then I got a little bit older, saw things that were a little bit more relevant to sort of a mature emotional life, and I drifted away from the Lynchian world of kind of weirdness and surface kind of oddity. But I think I've come back. You know, when I saw his last movie, Inland Empire, I just thought that was one of the greatest works of art ever created, and it is just such a head trip. I couldn't even tell you what it's about necessarily, but it kind of made me reconsider all the previous movies, you know, how that can happen.
Yeah.
So now, especially seeing the Twin Peaks, sharing it with Mary, who had never seen it before, and getting to see it through her eyes as a first time viewer, and just like her intuition about things that I really trust. And it's just, we've both been kind of enchanted again by the Lynchian things. I used to have a bit of a problem with the whole idea of like, you sort of esoteric mysteries that just kind of seem like nonsense and they don't necessarily have a kind of a basis in human behavior.
Yeah.
But I think that might have been a too quick of a gloss on what he's actually doing. I don't think he's being weird for its own sake. I think he is legitimately an odd human being, and he is just expressing that as best he can.
I believe that. I think I'm just broadly speaking just a little too vanilla for stuff like that.
Well, yeah, I agree with that.
I don't even like cartoons.
Well, cartoons. I know you have a thing about cartoons, but don't worry. I don't really like cartoons either. I mean, at least not the serious ones. You know, if it's a cartoon, it should be like childish.
Oh, but, no. I mean, I like the serious ones. The only ones I could watch were the Justice League, like the Super Friends. But all
right, whatever. Right, yeah, that's what I like too. But you know, when they try to be more, whatever, put that aside. I honestly think that you and Nikki sitting on a couch together watching Twin Peaks straight through could actually save your marriage.
Wow, all right, that's good to know. I mean, I don't like to sit on the couch with other people. I like to.
Yeah, well, she could sit wherever you want her to.
That's okay.
Leave me alone.
But actually, today's film that I want to bring to you is an older film. It's a little bit more politically relevant, at least in the explicit sense. And I just showed it to my senior citizens film appreciation class, and I got such a kick out of their reactions to it because this is a movie made in 1971, and it is somewhat of a mockumentary, which I know, Sam, you've worked in that genre.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it is a pseudo-documentary, so it's not necessarily making fun of the genre as much as just using it to tell this story. But it is by the director Peter Watkins, who's worked in this kind of milieu before, and it is called Punishment Park.
I've never even heard of this.
Well, great. I thought I knew all the faux verite films. Yeah, well, now here's another one for you to add to your collection. It's extremely politically explicit, and it takes place in a kind of semi-dystopian future, but also kind of present day.
Watch out, Haskell, it's real. It's not that.
No. Medium Cool? Is that what I think that one's called? Yeah. No, it's basically about what they call a punishment park, and it's a similar concept you've heard in other movies, but it basically the film centers on excuse me, a group of young students who are essentially like radicals or dissidents, and they're being put on trial by a panel of, it looks like the silent majority, like literally one woman's like a housewife. It's like her lower third is like housewife. And they're judging them for their political activism in this world where, you know, treason, you know, activism is now treason. And since the prisons are so full, they give you the option of either life imprisonment or run for your life in this punishment park with the cops and the military chasing you. So it's a little Running Man-ish, but again, like 15 years before Running Man.
And can you get, if you can get out, are you free?
That's right. So if you make it to the American flag, and you have to run through the harshest desert in like Nevada. So it's like you're on this you know, dusty plane being chased by armed officers, National Guardsmen, policemen. And it's a great, it's not funny necessarily, but there's a lot of sarcasm and humor in the reactions. And it's not just the reactions of the dissidents, which is made up of, you know, college kids, Black Panthers, anarchists, you know, these kinds of people. And it's brutal, you know, it doesn't end well for all the people. It's kind of a herky-jerky, kind of low-budget, kind of aesthetic, but it's, you know, mocking the kind of news documentary genre of the time, 16mm. And it's intercut with these students trying to defend themselves on this in this trial. And what they say in this trial, Sam, is so shocking because it could be a list of grievances that we have still today.
Right.
Everything from racial disparity to, you know, they saying things like the prisons are too filled up, saying things like education has become too hard to get. I mean, this is really like, you know, you talk a lot about the Powell memo and kind of like the first wave against that. This is really like prefiguring that. All the things that they bring up are shockingly current still. And so it's pretty harrowing, but it's also, you know, it's got some humor to it. And if you're interested in the history of these kinds of movements, I think you get a lot out of it, too, because the students are representing some of the actual dissident groups of the time. So it's like taking off in the trial of the Chicago Seven. It's got a real overtone of the Kent State shootings, you know, police brutality. Vietnam is talked about a lot. You know, you still hear about the Soviet Union, which, you know, it's a little bit dated, but I just think everyone should see this who is a political animal like you are.
So is it available? I assume this is only available on 16mm.
It's not available anywhere.
Right. Where can we watch
it? It's out there. It's out there.
Netflix?
I will have to double check that for you, but it is worth hunting down. There may actually even be a copy of it on YouTube, as a matter of fact. But it's okay. The Masters of Cinema series put it out, I think, about 10 years ago. So it is definitely available.
And what is it?
Available.
What is the name of it again?
Punishment Park.
Punishment Park by Peter Watkins. It sounds pretty good, actually.
It's really good.
And
Twin Peaks is also good.
Punishment Park by Peter Watkins. Well, Matthew, I think your work here is done. I'm looking forward
to
seeing that.
It's almost done.
Why? What else you got? Oh.
Well, Sam, yes.
All right. Go ahead.
May I? Thank you. That tape that you signed is still available.
What tape?
For bidding.
What tape?
You signed the tape of the great movie themes when I was in the studio last time.
A cassette tape.
And a cassette tape, yeah, that's right, featuring your actual handwritten signature on the tape. And that can be anyone within the sound of my voices for a mere $5.
What is your eBay page? Do you have like a... Matthew, what?
Langdon Boom.
Why don't you do this? Why don't you set up a URL that forwards directly to your eBay page?
I have it, and it's in my Twitter handle or my Twitter bio, so you can find it there. Langdon Boom, at Langdon Boom, and then you can find it right in my description.
You don't understand what I'm saying.
It goes right to the page.
If you have a URL that you buy, Langdon Boom eBay.
Oh, I see.
Then people...
Sure, that works. I can do that.
Well,
thank you for the endorsement of my.
No, I'm not endorsing it at all.
These things. Well, it was your idea, so I assume you think it's a good one.
Oh, the idea is a good idea.
Yeah.
Matthew Film Guy, thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure, Matthew Film Guy.
My pleasure, Sam. Talk to you later.
Thanks, buddy.
Bye bye.
All right, folks. We're gonna head into the fun half, wherein we will have fun. We have some more sound to play. We will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. Are you guys ready in BK?
We are ready in BK.
Hello.
I will be here on Monday. So we're just shuffling up the schedule. Although, wait a second. Yeah, okay. I'll be here on Monday. Monday, Michael, will probably happen on Thursday of this week, of next week. Don't forget, folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Honestly, we can't do it without you. Head over there and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out Michael and Matt on Twitter, of course. Michael is up to 239 supporters on Patreon for, let's see if I can figure this out, TMBS. Oh, yeah, trademark bullshit. That's the way that, that's just the way that I remember it.
That would actually be an amazing name for a show.
So head over to Patreon, trademark bullshit. That's the way you remember it. TMBS. That's the Michael Brooks show, or as I call it, trademark bullshit. it is a great, what do they call it? Mnemonic?
Yep. Mnemonic device.
Yeah. I remember that, Gary Busey was, that was always the thing. He would always say like, YIMBY. What? You, I meet because yesterday.
How come he never comes never out forget. To give a
well, if Busey's saying YIMBY, that's yes in my backyard. And if Busey's a YIMBY, that's a good look for Busey.
Oh, no, that's where we say, like, where do you want to shoot? YIMBY.
Okay.
I don't want to go. I can't go to Venice because the gang members are trying to kill me.
Okay, Gary, but I heard that there's a special spaceship portal in Venice, and if we shoot there in the next
That's where
hours,
we got to shoot. That's where we got to shoot. That's where we're shooting. We've got to shoot there. You know, I've been contacted by them many times. In fact, I have a video of it. It's still in the cellophane.
You had a preview of Trump.
Yeah, I really did. And I'll tell you, I mean, I directed that show 13 years ago, and for that summer, I was grayer than I am now, and I had a crease right here. I have it a little bit now, but I'm 14 years older. I had a crease right here because I would go to bed like this, and I was sleeping like this. So painful. I remember my buddy was the executive producer, and he's like, hey, man, we're going to send you down to San Diego for the weekend. And we're going to send you a bottle of champagne. You just felt so bad.
Can I read Social Security reports and have champagne and Gary doesn't bother me?
I will tell you, hello? At that time, this is before I had made my move into the politics talking politics as a career. And all I did was read Atreos. And at that time, and probably Liberal Oasis and Talking Points Memo and Daily Kos, back when those were like underground papers.
Wait, so is this like right around, were you doing Busey when we were about to invade Iraq?
We had invaded Iraq. It was the summer of 2003.
That must have felt so weird.
It was very strange, yeah. And I would get in arguments with people on the crew. Some of the people on the crew, I would listen to. I was in L.A. From basically that summer, and maybe 6 months, and I would spend my time calling into right-wing talk radio shows in California, and I'd be driving and I'd call into like the Ken, like they had like a Ken, they had a Ken and Ken show, I think it was. Or something like that. But, and that's when I realized, like, these guys don't know anything they're talking about. Because if you ask them one question, they fall apart.
But, yes.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, you know what's amazing, though, is that it's like the new version is, I feel like in today's environment, you don't even need to, like, you can... you don't need to even pretend that you know you're talking about, because you can just do the whole alternative narrative structure in reality. So it's like,
well, but they were doing that too. The difference is,
but they were lying, right? They would be like there are WMDs in Iraq, and now it would be like, yeah, we found them. What are you talking about?
I got news for you. That's what they were saying then too.
Where did they find them? In Syria or something?
Yes.
Oh, that.
Oh, the, every other day it was a story. Okay. Oh, they're in Syria. It's clear. We have pictures that they. I mean, no, none of this is new. The difference now is that then it was the mainstream narrative. Now our media is stratified enough so that there are competing narratives. Then that was the narrative. There was no. There was no, like, literally, the only place to get the news were from blogs that people had set up on Blogger, on like these third party, you know, movable type. And that was it. There, you know, that's the only way, like, you know, they would go out and aggregate these stories from McClatchy. I never had read a McClatchy story before, you know, where would I have access to it? This was the only way that you could get an alternative narrative. There was no, you know, on MSNBC at the time, it was Pat Buchanan and, you know, Jerry Nachman. I mean, there was no, and if you don't know who I'm talking about, exactly. They had fired Phil Donahue. Frank Luntz was the Chuck Todd at that time.
Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus is right. People don't, you know, there was no YouTube. If you streamed anything, it was all on Reel. There were no podcasts to speak of. It was a different era. Now Grandpa has to go take a nap. we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, the fun half. Bye-bye.
Sad. She said no.